this week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
The university has been, in fact, the day that the strike vote passed, they sent out an email, like the second that it passed, to the membership, telling us that it's illegal and et cetera, you know, basically trying to intimidate members.
A strike wave grows at the University of California campuses where students and workers protest the repression of anti-genocide encampments.
For the last 2 years, we've seen a terrible war which would end if this country and others would stop providing arms and instead seek peace.
Margaret Kimberly of the Black Agenda Report addresses the United Nations Security Council about weapons disarmament and the Ukraine proxy war.
People are kind of confused and, you know, they don't really know what to do at this point because they're not organized.
Independent journalist New reports on the union situation in Thailand.
Do you not know that a good man has died? Ladies and gentlemen, much of our conversation has been about how he died. But I do not want you to just see him as a statistic. Roger is not a hashtag.
Dr. Jamal Bryant honors the life and service of 23-year-old senior airman Roger Fortson, who was fatally shot 6 times by a Florida deputy as he stood in the doorway of his own home. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt. The 38,000 members of UAW 4811 at the University of California took a strike vote because of the UC Regents union busting and attacks on students. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed UAW 4811 member Peter Ross about the attacks on the encampments and what this means for all UC workers and labor as a whole.
The graduate students have recently taken a strike vote, in part over the attack by Zionists and right-wingers against a encampment at UCLA. And maybe, Peter, you can give us an update about what happened at that attack, some of the issues that your rank-and-file caucus is raising, and what you see as the way going forward.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Well, there was violence really almost from the very beginning of the encampment being set up, or not violence in the beginning, but sort of harassment, verbal harassment, and just sort of acts of intimidation. After a few days in, we had people sort of prowling around the perimeter late at night, and Proud Boys started showing up. And there was this rally on Sunday, a couple of days after it was formed, Zionist counter-protests that got quite violent in the middle of the day. But then on Tuesday night is when it really escalated, and there was a group of about 200, I would say, outside people mostly that came and, you know, shot fireworks into the camp and charged up against the barricades and tried to rip them apart and punched and hit people with poles. I know at least 25 people went to the emergency room and maced around 100 people, I think. So that was really, fascist violence, basically an attempt to destroy the camp physically, or at least intimidate protesters into leaving. I think they did plan to completely break it up, but the UC administration, the Chancellor Gene Block, he was actually present, apparently watching from a balcony for part of the time, and they stood by and let that happen for 3 hours and stood the police down by the look of it.
And the question of the complicity of the politicians, the mayor of Los Angeles, Bass, and Governor Gavin Newsom, who later brought in the Highway Patrol to remove the encampment. Do you think they were aware of this happening? I understand you're calling for an investigation to find out who was involved. And Seinfeld, apparently there was national financial support.
Yeah, there was certainly a lot of financial support. The counter-protests raised, I think, around $100,000 within the course of about a day. And they used it to have this gigantic screen sound system blasting at the camp at all hours. So certainly this was well-funded and well-organized. They kind of popped up out of nowhere. So it clearly, you know, you don't have 200 people appear suddenly unless it's been well-organized. So as for the chancellor's involvement, I mean, I think that the UC Regents wanted probably from the very beginning to come down on this. And I think Block, the chancellor, certainly he has a history of Zionist speech and actions as the chancellor. And there's no doubt that he, I mean, I've seen how quick the police responses can be in the past. And in this instance, there's no other explanation for the police not being called in for 3 hours. And I find it impossible to believe that this was not coordinated to some degree with, you know, city authorities, Karen Bass, the mayor, and as you said, you know, Governor Newsom, he's responsible for calling in the California Highway Patrol on us, which is the group that eventually succeeded in breaking up the encampment with riot gear and rubber bullets that they fired indiscriminately into the crowd. At least 5 students were struck in the head. So yeah, this is something that clearly was coordinated to some degree, and what we need really is a tribunal or committee in the UAW, in the student worker union, to investigate independently what happened, and especially the degree of coordination.
And the rise of fascism, I mean, this is not the Republicans, this is not Trump. These are Democrats who's involved and also have been involved in New York. What is the position of the union leadership in relationship to the Democrats' complicity, apparent complicity, in this physical assault and linked up with the Proud Boys and the Zionists in attacking the encampment?
Sorry, the relationship of the union bureaucracy?
Yes, I mean, the role of the union. Has the union protested Gavin Newsom's role and Karen Bass, the mayor of Los Angeles?
Well, no, the union has not. I mean, it's called a political strike, although so far it's only called that one campus. The messaging has not been explicitly political. I mean, there hasn't been, it's not directed against political figures like Gavin Newsom. So, and for the most part, the demands of the strike are things like amnesty for the students, protections for free speech and right to protest peacefully without being attacked by the police. That's the legal justification. At the same time, the union has said that they are in solidarity with the student protesters and support their demands and the university, or that they're trying to compel the university to negotiate with the student protesters rather than attack them. But there are shortcomings in the union's demands. For instance, they've completely left out a key demand of the student movement, which is cops off campus, which has become very clear lately how important that is. Yeah, I mean, really the most glaring issue right now in terms of union leadership is that they have called a strike, but 2 weeks have now passed since the attacks on the 30th and the 1st, and we're still not on strike except at a relatively small campus in Santa Cruz. So really, the union needs to immediately call out all of the campuses across the entire state.
And CNN did a report exposing the faces, the people that were involved in this attack. There have been no arrests of any of these people. I mean, it's really a criminal conspiracy, apparently, to physically assault the encampment. Yet there have been no arrests. Are there any demands that these people be held accountable who physically assaulted the encampment?
That's not a demand of the strike, but certainly it's a demand that a lot of people in the community are making. And it's inexplicable, you know. 200-something student protesters were arrested for peacefully protesting. And in fact, Irvine, which has also attacked its student protesters with police, I think yesterday or the day before announced that they're going to be suspending all of the students that were arrested. So the university is really going after the student protesters quite hard. But it has, yeah, I mean, when there was a violent attack on this campus by fascists, they were allowed to leave unimpeded and without any consequences. And despite the fact that they've been exposed by a number of outlets, you know, the Gray Zone, CNN, have exposed some of these people's identities. Also, the LA People City Council has done a lot of that work. You know, these people are not being pursued. So that really says something about the role of the police and who they really defend.
And the issue of the working class and the rest of the trade union movement, this is a political assault on the students' democratic rights, but an attack on the union as well. And the university is fighting your unfair labor practice strike, saying that you don't have the right to strike over this physical assault on the students and the staff. The issue of mobilizing the rest of the working class. Is that important? And the LA Fed and what the rest of the unions are going to do or not do about this issue of this basically conspiracy by the fascists, by the Zionists to attack the encampment?
Well, the university has been, in fact, the day that the strike vote passed, they sent out an email, like the second that it passed, to the membership telling us that it's illegal and et cetera, you know, basically trying to intimidate members. And they filed injunctions and they're claiming that it's not a legal strike because it's a political strike. And so, yeah, I mean, there's an attempt to intimidate the unions, intimidate the membership. And Gene Block, the chancellor, is going to testify before Congress tomorrow. And he's going to be questioned by right-wing fascistic political figures that are going to demand further repression and basically attack also the union and the union's right to strike over something like this. So really, it is an attack on the whole working class because it's an attack on fundamental democratic rights, right to protests. And I mean, you know, the charge against the student protesters was unlawful assembly. So, you know, I thought the right to assemble was guaranteed in the Constitution, but apparently, you know, that's being attacked. So yeah, it's an attack on workers. You know, there were AFSCME workers there, there were UPD workers. It's an attack on everybody's right to strike and have political speech. So absolutely, we need to get more of the labor movement involved. Yeah, you know, I think this is one small step in that direction. But I know ILWU, there's a resolution on stopping shipments of weapons to Israel. So that would be incredibly important if that passes. And yeah, I think there's a lot of pro-Palestine caucuses that have formed in various unions, SEIU and SAG-AFTRA and several others. So, you know, I think the rank and file caucuses have led this organizing in my union, and I think that there's potential for them to do that in unions around the country.
That was Peter Ross, UC graduate student and member of UAW 4811. UCLA will be going on strike on Tuesday, May 28th with UC Davis.
We knew in the 1980s chaos, catastrophe was on the way. Plants shutting down like crazy. The moment was coming, that's here today. Working class children and babies, the world's been stolen and laid to waste. Future generations gonna say to me, did you stand up and show your face? Rise and fight, let's unite. Militant unions are what I like. Raise your voice, got no choice. Time for a general strike.
Music by Mike Stoud, Time for a General Strike. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Next, Black Alliance for Peace member and executive editor of Black Agenda Report, Margaret Kimberly, spoke in front of the United Nations Security Council on May 20th, 2024, about weapons disarmament and the Ukraine proxy war.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. Thank you all for this opportunity to address the Security Council and to provide a briefing on the issue of peace as it relates to Ukraine and its connections with people in this country and all over the world. As a journalist, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace and the United National Anti-War Coalition, and as a citizen of the United States, the nation taking a lead role in continuing the crisis, I'm eager to speak to this issue. As of now, the U.S. has allocated nearly $175 billion for the Ukrainian war effort and to support the workings of Ukraine's civilian government. For the last 2 years, we've seen a terrible war which would end if this country and others would stop providing arms and instead seek peace. There were opportunities for that to happen in March and April of 2022, when the government of Turkey hosted peace talks between Ukraine and the Russian Federation. The possibility of peace was lost when my country and others subverted these talks by promising the government of Ukraine that it would receive an endless supply of weapons with which to achieve a military victory. Not only has that victory been elusive, but thousands of Ukrainians, the people this country claims to care so much about, have lost their lives. And of course, many Russians have also perished. The goal should be for the death toll to end for both nations. We don't have to guess why this huge sum of money has been spent. We need only recall what the President of the United States and his foreign policy team have said publicly. The Secretary of Defense famously said in a rare moment of candor that the U.S. wanted to, quote, see Russia weakened, unquote. This is a dangerous goal for the United States to have at all. The world needs cooperation. It's the only way to avoid escalation and disastrous outcomes between the major powers. The U.S. shouldn't be attempting to weaken any nation, but should be continuously engaged in finding ways to prevent and to end conflict. Not only is the Secretary's confession dangerous, but it has surely failed. President Biden himself said that U.S.-imposed sanctions against Russia would, quote, turn the ruble to rubble, unquote. No such thing has happened, and other nations have suffered economically from the futile effort to keep Russian oil off of world markets. Global South nations in particular were most impacted by what turned out to be a failed effort. More developed nations, those in Europe, have been deprived of affordable gas supplies they reliably received from Russia for decades. There have been other serious consequences, and some of them have fallen on people in this country, the one most responsible for continuing the crisis. Project Ukraine, as it is called, is a bipartisan effort, with both Republicans and Democrats supporting the continued infusion of huge sums of money to the defense industry, the military-industrial complex, and to dubious projects in Ukraine itself. This funding is not just spent on the military, but is literally supplying many domestic government functions within that country. Most Americans are unaware, for example, that small businesses in Ukraine are being supported with their public funds, with at least $25 billion in non-military aid being spent. It isn't as if people in this country don't need help. Money for weapons continues, thanks to consensus among the political class, while needy people here are being removed from the Medicaid program, which pays for health care for low-income people, as well as the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. Students take on thousands of dollars in debt to attend universities. The same administration, which is committed to spending money on weapons, has never presented a plan to help the estimated 500,000 people in the U.S. who are unhoused. There are constant calls to cut or end these programs altogether, but the funding stream for war remains untouched. Democracy itself is in crisis because of these endless conflicts. War is not the only indicator of violence in the world, and peace is not just the absence of conflict. War-making leads to immiseration, which is antithetical to the concept of peace. The U.S. public do not have the unanimity of opinion on Ukraine that one would expect, considering that billions of dollars have been allocated. Even those who say they support this effort also say they would like to see negotiations too. A recent poll indicated that 71% of people in this country would like to see a negotiated settlement instead of ongoing conflict. But the millions of Americans who want an end to the conflict have been deprived of the representation we are supposed to have. Not only does the administration refuse to reconsider its position, but there are reports that President Biden wants to prevent future presidents from playing a different role. According to President Zelensky, he's working with the U.S. and other NATO nations on a 10-year plan to provide weapons. Joe Biden can only serve for a maximum of 4.5 more years, meaning that he wants to make a commitment that a future president cannot change. In so doing, he invalidates the concerns of voters in this country and of the people who are supposed to represent them. As a citizen of the United States, I'm shocked by the lengths this country will go to in order to pursue a dangerous plan that's doomed to fail. The most recent tranche of U.S. weapons funding is dependent upon Ukraine mobilizing men, approximately 500,000. Several million Ukrainians fled to nearby states in 2022, but now they are told they cannot renew their passports abroad. They must return to Ukraine, where we see videos of men literally being press ganged into service, dragged off the street and forced to join the military. The freedom that is allegedly being fought for seems to require a lack of freedom for Ukrainians who face the risk of death in the battlefield. This corruption requires a steady stream of indoctrination and propaganda to keep the U.S. population from asking questions or actively opposing the war. I suppose that is why Secretary of State Antony Blinken thought it wise to perform with the Ukrainian band on his last visit to Kiev. Not only that, but neither the secretary nor his handlers were aware that the song he performed, Rockin' in the Free World, is a lament about poverty and hopelessness in a supposedly free world, which isn't truly free. The administration is so divorced from reality, they thought it wise for Secretary Blinken to play this song as men are rounded up to be cannon fodder. I want to add that this conflict didn't begin in February 2022. It began years earlier with the U.S. plan to have Ukraine join NATO. In 2008, William Burns, then U.S. ambassador to Russia, revealed in a cable known to us because of the work of WikiLeaks that doing so would cross a Russian red line and potentially lead to, quote, a major split involving violence or at worst civil war, unquote. As we all know, WikiLeaks publisher Julian Assange languishes in a UK prison facing extradition to the country that has made an example of him because he has revealed secrets such as this cable. I reiterate that there have been peace proposals in the past 2 years, with the most recent effort being made by the People's Republic of China, which has developed a comprehensive 12-point plan that could mean the end of destruction and suffering if it's given serious consideration. Lastly, I would make a plea to the United Nations to use its power to investigate a catastrophic event that is tied to the Ukraine conflict. On September 26, 2022, the Nord Stream pipelines were destroyed in an explosion which also sent 15 million tons of CO2 into the atmosphere, thus contributing to global warming. Investigations have been closed without conclusion, and at least one internationally known investigative journalist has provided evidence of U.S. involvement. Sadly, no one in a position to investigate in this country has demanded that. It is imperative that the United Nations undertake an independent investigation of its own. This is only possible if fantasies about domination are finally and firmly rejected. Doing so would free nations to be honest with one another, to struggle over issues, but to resolve them without death or expenditures of money that are better used for human needs. I thank you all profusely for this opportunity and for the work of the Security Council in upholding the United Nations Charter on behalf of the people of the world. Thank you very much.
That was Margaret Kimberly, executive editor of Black Agenda Report and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace, speaking at the United Nations Security Council on May 20th.
Yeah, yeah. We like to rock and y'all, Rebel Diaz, all power to the people. As long as you're playing for the other team, the hood ain't living the American dream. Yo, I ain't never scared, so we get prepared, cause if not, we left stuck in this nightmare. Ayo, these rappers made it rain, so my flight's delayed. So I look for sunny days, creating my own lane. See, life takes a toll, so I live the freeway. You playing for the wrong team, you should just request a trade. What if King James was like Muhammad Ali? Okay, what if Jay-Z talked about getting free? Instead of more beef, we need more green. So we plant more trees on these concrete streets. Please don't leave when you get that degree. Fat cats get the cheese, but we ain't making no breeze. See, I stay on the block like return deliveries. And I don't want your company if it includes misery. My gender ain't secret, it's not a mystery. I'm ahead of my time, so the present's missing me. I bet the story will be different in the history pages if Tupac would've never set foot in Vegas. As long as you're playing for the other team, the hood ain't living the American dream. dream. Yo, I ain't never scared.
Never scared.
So get prepared.
Get prepared.
Now we left stuck in this nightmare.
And yo, news lie to ya. Schools don't school ya. Cops wanna shoot ya.
What you gonna do about it?
Rich get richer. Poor get thinner. How comfortable your pillow?
So what you gonna do about it?
I got a fresh pair of Nikes. Make me feel nice. Yeah. Like I'm worth more according to what I buy. Ay, mama, no estabas equivocada. The system that bought us, sell out, forget bottom. Yeah. Drawn by the dollars, not God or Allah. Except when they invoke to gain more power. Allah, border, follow the code. Cause if not, you're left out alone in the cold, bruh. See, it's a price on peace. High price to get a piece. Small slice of that pie, make your beast. Crabs in the bucket, it's a must you get above it. If you ain't sharing abundance, then you ain't about nothing. Bugging if you think we could be one of them. By making more ends, you're just playing pretend. And when you hit that concrete ceiling, even after making millions, you won't see my vision.
Cause as long as you're playing for the other team, the hood ain't living the American dream. Yo, I ain't never scared, so we get prepared. Cause if not, we let stuck in this nightmare. Cause as long as you're playing for the other team, the hood ain't the American dream. Yo, I ain't never scared, so we get prepared. Cause if not, we left stuck in this nightmare.
That was Rebel Diaz, American Nightmare. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Protest is growing against U.S.-supported royalty in Thailand. Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer interviewed labor researcher Nu, who is also a volunteer at the Thai Labor Museum in Bangkok. Nu reports on the union situation in Thailand.
Union culture in Thailand focus quite a lot on economic unionism, which means that you comply to the law, like always, very strictly, and you try to organize and campaign within your workplace only, not even in the same industry. And a lot of times they would try to make you pick a side, you know, when you want to campaign on some topic or whatever, between pak tong, which means mouth and stomach, which means like just wages and stuff like that, and politics. And a lot of them would try to pitch that politics is a utopian idealism or something like that, even when we just talk about, you know, basic human rights or something like that. But basically a lot of unions in Thailand would only tackle very small and very conservative topics, well, like wages, bonus, parking lots for like union members and stuff like that. Labor unions have to be political. Like, we need political strikes, we need political movement in unions, we need unions to go out in the streets to, you know, commit to any kind of like political movement as well, or else like it's basically gonna end up like what, like the situation in Thailand right now, which is just, you know, unions supporting any right-wing movement and unions neglecting social movement and, you know, like social issues in general.
Is there a rise of fascism in Thailand?
Oh, I would say it has always been the fascist, you know, look place.
The AFL-CIO Solidarity Center operates in 62 countries. They get $75 million from the U.S. government, and they are in Thailand, saying that they're helping the Thai people. What has been your experience of the U.S. government, the State Department, and the Solidarity Center here in Thailand?
So at one meeting, I have been meeting with the, you know, basically organizations, you know, belonging to the U.S. So the U.S. Embassy, the Labor Department, and, you know, Foreign Relations something, I don't remember the exact name, they have, you know, asked to set up a meeting with unions in Thailand, so State Enterprise Union and an informal labor organization called the Solidarity Committee or something, I don't know what it's called in Thai. And basically, you know, asked us, you know, what kind of support do we want? And we answered that we want the ratification of ILO Conventions 87 and 98, because it's super hard to organize, you know, labor around here. And we need that to, you know, push some more laws into, you know, the Thai law. and we did not, you know, get a clear answer or, you know, commitment from the U.S. side on that day. And I would describe Thailand as a U.S. base. For example, like we have been conditioned to become this stronghold in Southeast Asia.
Who is organizing in Thailand now? Are there any organizing campaigns?
There's one, basically a labor rights group. Like they try to be a union, like they try to become a general union, much like, you know, the IWW, for example. But it's still very small. Everything is like really small. Traditional unions, they can organize outside of their own workplace. One of the first thing you can do is like, you know, follow Socialist Workers Thailand on social media, follow the Workers Union on social media. These are internationalist, left-wing, anti-capitalist, you know, anti-racist, anti-bigotry, all of that, pro-LGBTQ organizations in Thailand. They're still quite small, but I think if you want to, you know, provide some international support, you can follow them and maybe, you know, share stories sometimes. The labor movement as a whole is really small in Thailand.
What about the student movement?
The student movement, they're quite gone now because they do not organize. They just call for protests, you know, every now and then. It's quite different from what's going on in the US, which is, you know, a lot of organizing, right? Students in Thailand rely a lot on leaders. And once the leaders are all in jail, we have around 40-ish political prisoners right now. Sometimes, you know, the number goes up, sometimes the numbers go down. We have a lot of political prisoners right now. Those are leaders of the student movement, you know, from 2020 to 2023. Since we don't have leaders anymore and a general election had just happened, even though it was stolen, people are kind of confused and, you know, they don't really know what to do at this point because they're not organized.
New water. To talk about the death of a prisoner, political prisoner, her name was Netpon Bung, and maybe you can talk about who she was and what happened to her.
Basically, she was a fellow activist. She was staunch pro-democracy activist. One of her, you know, most notable action is that she did this paper poll. So, you know, she and her friends, you know, went around popular, you know, tourist areas in Bangkok. She you know, they had this huge paper on one side, you know, there's this big question on top, you know, basically asking, you know, if the royal motorcade, which is something, you know, very, very common in Thailand, you know, that the monarchy would just, you know, travel around and, you know, they close down the roads whenever they do that. And, you know, the poll would ask, you know, if this, you know, royal motorcade thing, you know, hinders your daily life, like your everyday life or not. And, you know, you can take like this small little sticker, small circular sticker. I think it was in green or something. And you can place it either on the side of like, yes, it, you know, it kind of bothers me a little. And like, no, it doesn't bother me at all. And, you know, they went around just doing this paper poll. And, you know, security guards and, you know, right-wing groups, you know, were basically mad at them and, you know, tried to stop them, you know, several times from doing this. But in the end, a point was made. So first, no one wants to allow, like the authorities, like doesn't want to allow this poll to happen, even though it's just, you know, a very, you know, amateurish paper poll. And also the answers are always consistently, because they did this like a few times around Bangkok, right? And the answers have been consistently saying that, yes, the royal motorcade, you know, bothers people. and you know, that earned them a royal defamation charge. I think, I'm not sure actually, because royal defamation in Thailand can be pinned on someone, basically by anyone at all. You know, if you're Thai, I think you have to be a citizen or something like that. I'm not sure. But basically you can walk to your closest police station and then you can file a charge, you know, against someone for royal defamation. And Netpon or Bung, you know, got 112, Article 112 charge or lese majeste or royal defamation just because of that. And she was put into jail for a really long period of time, you know, a couple of times as well. Like she went, she was released and imprisoned again, you know, a few times over the course of like a year or so. And, you know, the last like 110 days, she was on a hunger strike. And basically, you know, that caused that, you know, probably this is, you know, not the official statement from, you know, the hospital or anything like that. But, you know, it kind of played a part in her death on the 14th of May, 2024. And Thailand right now, especially right now, is very common for people to be charged with 112 or royal defamation and basically get detained even before, you know, getting any verdict at all. Like you basically get detained for a year or two or something like that. And, you know, that was happening to her. She was doing a hunger strike, you know, with a few of her friends as well. You know, there are at least, you know, two other people, like maybe more, doing hunger strikes as well. And, you know, she was protesting the fact that, you know, she's being locked up in jail without ever being found guilty of anything at all. And basically, she died.
That was labor researcher and independent journalist New speaking to Pacifica Steve Zeltzer in Bangkok. Thai musician Jik Phumisak, The Anti-Imperialist March. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Hundreds attended the service of the U.S. Senior Airman Roger Fortson, who was 23 years old, on May 17, 2024, at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Stone Creek, Georgia, near Atlanta. An Okaloosa County Sheriff's deputy shot Fortson in his own home in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, on May 3, 2024, after someone from the complex called the police to report, quote, possible domestic violence. At the time, Fortson was along with his dog while talking to his girlfriend on FaceTime. To date, the caller nor the deputy have been identified. According to reports, the officer and not Fortson opened fire within seconds. Supervisors say the deputy acted in self-defense. During a press conference, Fortson's legal team, which includes civil rights attorney Ben Crum, reminded the press of his Second Amendment rights in a state that helped popularize Stand Your Ground laws after the killing of Trayvon Martin more than a decade ago. Dr. Jamal Bryant began the eulogy of Senior Airman Roger Fortson with a story about civil rights icon Medgar Evers' Army service during World War II.
Prior to becoming a pastor, I was a National Youth and College Director of the NAACP. One of the stalwarts of liberty was a gentleman by the name of Medgar Evers. Joy Reid wrote a powerful book entitled Medgar and Merle. And in it, she chronicles that in the spring of 1946, Medgar Evers returned to Jackson, Mississippi after serving in the United States Army as a decorated veteran. Upon returning to this country after landing on the beaches of Normandy and fighting for freedom in Germany, Medgar Evers wanted that same freedom that he fought for in Germany to be evident in Mississippi. So he began to work, he began to organize, he began to plan, and he began to register people to vote. He was fearless and courageous. He was a military man and a civil rights leader. He was a son, he was a husband, and he was a father. He was a citizen, and he was a dreamer. But little did Mega know that 17 years after being honorably discharged, that in the early morning hours of June 12, 1963, another veteran, a veteran of World War II, a man who served in the United States Marine Corps as a machine gunner, a man by the name of Byron Della Beckwith, would shoot him down in the carport outside of his own home. It showed all of America that you can wear a uniform and the uniform won't protect you. That regrettably, sometimes the skin you wear is more of a magnet to opposition than the uniform that you bear. Because in America, before people see you as a veteran, as an airman in the United States Air Force, they'll see you as a black man. Dr. King would shudder in his feet to know that still in 2024, people are judged by the color of their skin before the content of their character. Wearing a uniform doesn't make you safe against the malfactions of bigotry. Wearing a uniform does not give you a restraining order against white supremacy. Because when you are black, even other people who wear uniforms for a living will assume that you are a threat to their life. The uniform is supposed to make you identify yourself. Regrettably, it wasn't that long ago that police officers went to an active military person's home and they did not identify themselves. The life we live is supposed to identify yourself. Langston Hughes had never enlisted in the Army. He was never in the Air Force, never in the Marines. But Langston Hughes, standing at 5'2", living in a one-bedroom apartment on Lenox Avenue in the height of the Harlem Renaissance, here was Langston Hughes' uniform. He said, "I too sing America. They ask me to eat in the kitchen when company comes. But I just laugh and eat well and grow strong, for tomorrow they'll see that I too am America." And he did that wearing no uniform. There is an interesting phenomenon, because it teaches us that when people can't control you, they'll seek to destroy you. When they can't make you subservient, then they'll strike you down. When people deny you the presumption of innocence and the affirmation of virtue, they jump to deadly conclusions without even giving you the chance to explain. How are we really going to sit in this place today for almost 2 hours and not talk about how it is that Roger was killed in his own home with 6 bullets in his body without anybody identifying themselves? Are we really going to sit here today and act as if Roger died of cancer? Roger died of a stroke, that Roger died of hypertension? Are you really going to sit here today as if Roger is the victim of gang violence? Are you really going to sit here today and act as if Roger died of a brain aneurysm? We got to call it as it is. Roger died of murder. He died of stone cold murder, and somebody has got to be held accountable. Are we going to feign as if Roger could not lawfully own the gun? Are we going to act as if because he was black, he was not protected by the Constitution he defended? Roger was 23 years old, a member of the United States Air Force, in his own house, with a firearm that was registered and legal, and a police officer came to his door and shot him up like a dog in the street, as if he was not defending the rights of America all over the world. I gotta stop right here, because I wanna say to you what it is that a lot of you will not like, and that is Roger was better to America than America was to Roger. We owe him a debt of gratitude and a debt of thanksgiving. Roger had the Second Amendment on his side.
and he had a right to bear arms. I want to say what may not be popular, but what is absolutely true. The preamble of the Constitution said, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and have the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Roger had a right. And if George Zimmerman had a right to carry a gun, then Roger had a right. If Kyle Rittenhouse had a right to carry a gun, then Roger had a right. If Dylann Roof had a right, then Roger had a right. We've got to be able to defend the rights of those who love America and pledge allegiance to the flag. I flew here this morning, and while it is that I was en route to this service, I stopped in my tracks. Because the number one golfer in America was stopped early this morning because he was on the way to a PGA tour. He did not listen to the police. He ran his car past the police, threatening the physical body of police officers. And you're not going to believe what they did. They arrested him. They fingerprinted him. They took his mugshot. But by 10 o'clock, they released him to play golf. Something is wrong in America. If in fact you have respect as a golfer, but you don't have a respect for an Air Force person who has given their life to this nation, you cannot remain silent in the face of injustice. Roger, ladies and gentlemen, was killed in cold blood, and all over the nation, people have been asking, is Roger's dog all right? But they're not asking, is his mama all right? Not asking, is his little brother all right? Not asking, is Harmony all right? Not asking, is his father all right? And I came to tell America, we ain't all right. This is not right, what has happened on today. This is the land of the free and the home of the brave. Cannot defeat what it is that you do not name. James Baldwin said, you cannot fix it until you face it. And today, ladies and gentlemen, we do not come as Democrats or Republicans. We come as Americans telling America, you got to fix this. Biden, if you want to be president again, fix this. Donald Trump, if you want to be president, fix this. Congress and Senate, you gotta fix this. Before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free. There comes a place where we can no longer be silent. Do you not know that a good man has died? Ladies and gentlemen, much of our conversation has been about how he died. But I do not want you to just see him as a statistic. Roger is not a hashtag. Roger is a son. He is a brother. He is a nephew. He is a man. And he is an American. And I need somebody to give a standing ovation for a man who lived for something. A man who stood for something. A man that believed in something. He was a prince among men. He stood head and shoulders above the status quo. I am so grateful that our paths were able to cross his path. I have some gentlemen and some ladies and some commanders who are present on today, and they were there. They weren't there in the apartment. They weren't there when the person from the apartment complex called the police, but they were there. They were there when somehow or another, by the grace of God, Roger was able to survive the streets of Atlanta. And he lifted up his right hand. He said, I, Roger Fortson, do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, and I will obey the orders of the President of the United States and the orders of the office appointed over me according to the regulations and uniform code of military justice. So help me, God. But I come today to take another oath. I so solemnly swear that if God be for me, who can be against me? I swear no weapon that is formed against us shall be able to prosper. I swear that in the time of trouble, he will hide us. I swear that you'll prepare a table in the presence of our enemies. The second creed of this Air Force is a simple one. And that simple creed is, I am an American airman. My mission is to fly, to fight, and to win. That is the mission that he took. And that is the mission that we all take. Do you realize how courageous he was? How strong he was? Ladies and gentlemen, we got to learn how to land right. We got to make sure that we live a life that the next generation that comes behind us will know that we only got to do three things: fly, fight, and win. That's what I came to tell some young person who's not sure what you're going to do about your future. Fly, fight, and win.
That was an excerpt of Dr. Jamal Bryant's eulogy of Senior Airman Roger Fortson in Stone Creek, Georgia, outside of Atlanta. Fortson was fatally shot by a Florida deputy in his home. Family, friends, community members, and a sea of Blue Air Commandos attended the celebration of life in support of Fortson, including Colonel Patrick Derrick, commander of 1st Special Operations Wing of Hurlburt Field, where Fortson was stationed. Derrick said he would, quote, love to take credit for making Fortson great, but the truth is that he was great before he came to us, and the Air Force merely polished a diamond that you forged. He further stated, quote, Senior Airman Fortson was a man of honor, integrity, and courage. Machari Dunbar, an Air Force retiree who serves on the board of the Black Veterans Project, said, quote, many of us are just saddened and angered by the continued unnecessary loss of Black lives at the hands of police, and we want to know how many times do officers have to get it wrong before they do something collectively to get it right. Senior Airman Roger Fortson was awarded the Air Medal with a combat device in 2023.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure, we will be sure.
To the heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtapositioning us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, his spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots, we on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, glory.
That was Common and John Legend, Glory. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all the Pacifica sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective with contributions from Steve Zeltzer, Ann Garrison, Paulina Vasiliev, and myself, Akua Holt. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at PacificaCRD. I've been your host, Akua Holt. Thanks for listening.